Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, the roster of 2020 presidential candidates got even longer this week. Democratic Senator Kamala Harris announced her run for president, followed closely by the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. We're going to dig into this ever-expanding field with everything from people representing 40 million constituents to people representing, you know, a few hundred thousand.
Is he the first Maltese American ever to run for president? Pete Buttigieg?
Excellent question, Charlie. One I'm sure we'll dig into.
Chris, can you look into that?
Plus, the shutdown is still happening. It's been 34 days at the time of this taping, and it looks like things are going to get even longer. We'll have White House reporter Nancy Cook joining to update us once more on just what's going on here inside the White House and all the drama surrounding this messy battle. As always, we are taping this at about noon Eastern on Thursday. Today, that's Thursday, January 24th, so it's all up to date as of then. Who knows what mayors might jump into the presidential race by the time this is released. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests returning. We have Chris Catalago, a national political reporter for Politico. Hi, Chris.
Hi, nice to be back.
Thanks for being here. And making his Nerdcast debut, I believe, we have another Politico national political reporter, Nolan McCaskill. Nolan, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And as always, senior politics editor Charlie Mutesian. Charlie, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to hazing Nolan.
Well, you know, on that front, actually, a big announcement to make. Charlie has taken two steps forward, but one step back on the technology front. He's got a new iPhone, but he has permanently given up trying to connect to the Wi-Fi.
I'm not even going to answer that.
All right, time for our first data point, $1.5 million. That's how much money Kamala Harris, the California senator, raised in the first 24 hours of her presidential campaign, as reported by Chris Catalago. So, Chris, you wrote a story about this. You also wrote a story about kind of what's going on behind the scenes on the Harris campaign getting going. And you know, tell us a little bit about that and how this big financial haul, and it is big, and it's the first one that we've heard so far, how that fits into this.
So I think you could look at that in a couple ways. One, I think it's a demonstration of at least a good amount of excitement out there for her. It shows something we have not seen borne out in the other candidates yet, that there are a lot of people out there who are at least excited enough to give sort of a first or maybe even a second small dollar contribution. The vast majority of those are under $250. That's kind of the marker they use. The other thing is it shows the strength of the digital operation that she's built. She's brought people in-house. They've spent a huge amount of money over the last 2 years building out that list that they have. And so I think those two things, you know, this is at the very least sort of a reward for what they've been doing.
And being able to do that digital politicking is such a big part of modern campaigns. But you also wrote this week about ways in which Harris has some troublesome fits with her record and the modern Democratic Party. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so she's got a long record, more than a decade, being a state attorney general and district attorney, and before that, a prosecutor. And so her campaign has had to look at ways to square that with the modern Democratic Party and the Black Lives Matter movement and a lot of changes that have happened on the left since she first got into politics. And so this idea of being tough on crime, of not necessarily interjecting in you know, sentencing reform, drug reform, things like that, have come back and people have started to question and say, you know, why weren't you further out front on some of these things? The question is, you know, how is that going to play for her? Unlike some of these other candidates, like Kirsten Gillibrand, for instance, who could kind of explain, you know, I changed my position on immigration, I changed my position on guns. Harris, you know, really needs to sort of stick by this career that she's had and really try to find a way to make it work for her, because there's no real way to distance herself from this.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nolan, meanwhile, you wrote this week about a way in which Harris very much fits in with the modern Democratic Party. I mean, she tell us about your story and her campaign's focus on South Carolina and the head start that Harris has in that pivotal primary state.
Right. So South Carolina is a state that a lot of candidates are trying to get into early. We all know it's one of the first four primary states. It is the most diverse state among that. And Harris has this unique tie to a lot of people in that community because she graduated from Howard University. It's a state that has eight HBCUs. She's an AKA. She pledged there at Howard. She'll actually be there in South Carolina on Friday attending a Pink Eyes Gala being hosted by a local chapter that is AKA. So her first introduction to South Carolina this year, she's going to be around a friendly audience. This is a place where President Barack Obama spoke in 2008. This is a place where people are excited to see her. They're excited to be around her. They're excited that she's one of their first stops since she's launched her campaign. And it's a unique network that she has that no other candidate has. There is one other candidate who is an HBCU graduate, but he's not a black Greek. He's not a top-tier candidate. So she's really got this lane that if she can tap into that, it could be a big fundraising network. It could be a big grassroots effort. These are people who are active in their community. They're around. I saw them in South Carolina on Monday for MLK Day. And if she's just able to tap into this network, she could have they could have a pretty big impact on her race and her chances to become a Democratic nominee.
Yeah, and you wrote in your story, is this the biggest, it's the oldest African-American sorority, correct?
I believe it is. I did get some pushback from Roland Martin about whether it's the biggest or not the biggest.
I gotcha.
Apparently,
okay.
People in the black community feel like the Delta organization is the biggest organization, so there's some rivaling going on there.
Right, but that's going to be a toehold for her in a state where I think you said about 4 out of 10 Democratic primary voters in recent years have been African American women, and Harris herself obviously is going to there's going to be other women in the field. It looks like Cory Booker is also going to run. There's going to be another African American senator in the field, but there's this lane for her that could potentially be decisive to get this head start in South Carolina. Charlie, where big picture, where do you see Harris fitting into the 2020 field that is quickly ballooning before our eyes?
Well, I think she's had a great rollout in a lot of ways. I think the campaigns we've seen so far, at least Elizabeth Warren's, have had pretty successful rollouts, and I think you can make pretty persuasive arguments of how they really did themselves a lot of good in the way they launched their campaigns. Harris, I would say, has had a very successful one, in part because of the friendly formats that she utilized before getting in. I think it was really smart the way she started out in focusing on South Carolina and showing up here on in South Carolina on Friday and organizing and hiring some top staff. And I also I'm not somebody who thinks that this knock on her. On her prosecutorial background is really going to hurt her. I know that there's a lot of talk about that. But, I mean, we've never really seen that before become a huge problem. This would be the first time that we're ever actually going to have a discussion about was she kinder and gentler enough as a prosecutor? And I just don't see a real constituency out there that really cares and is really motivated about these issues yet. And motivated enough to stop her. She has a lot of momentum coming in from the Trump administration and the high-profile role she's played in a lot of these nomination hearings. I think she's been investing a lot of money in a digital infrastructure that'll power her fundraising. So I think there's a lot there that makes her candidacy really attractive and certainly will be for the next year.
Yeah, and I was going to say, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but the question I am starting to think about, and you hear this from within the Harris campaign, is, you know, look at them on a debate stage. Imagine them out there. And who's really who is going to capitalize by bringing up these particular issues? Is it, you know, Bernie Sanders? Is it Beto O'Rourke? And how is that going to be sort of digested by a national audience when you have an African-American woman who has worked in this field for decades and knows it a lot better than them responding? I don't know how that attack necessarily works, and especially given her background and expertise in the field and also just her profile as a woman and a candidate. I don't know how that shot lands.
No, Nolan, Chris, I'm wondering, you know, we talking about South Carolina, obviously one of the four early states, as you mentioned, Nolan, obviously very important. I think the winner there has pretty much always. I think Newt Gingrich in 2012 is pretty much the only winner of South Carolina who hasn't gone on to win either party's nomination. But the person who usually, Gingrich notwithstanding, the person who wins South Carolina usually has won at least one of Iowa or New Hampshire beforehand, right? And which of those is Harris also going to be focusing especially on one of those two earlier, much whiter much different looking demographically states in order to kind of make sure that she gets that boost to survive long enough in the calendar to get to a state like South Carolina where she's been working these connections already.
Yeah, I think this is where you see her try to kind of put together the type of coalition Obama had in Iowa. I wouldn't bank a ton on New Hampshire at this point. Obviously, she's staffing up there and looking to make some inroads. But I think Iowa, if you were to look at those two states, would be the one that she would focus more on.
And I think South Carolina, you can't really overstate how important it's going to be. And just by looking at the last two important Democratic presidential primaries there, it was pivotal to Barack Obama and really powered his campaign. And it was a devastating blow to Hillary Clinton to lose that way. And in fact, the godfather of Democratic politics in South Carolina, who Nolan recently talked to, Jim Clyburn, talked about that a little bit with Nolan. And Nolan, you can say more about the Clyburn role, but Clyburn got that angry call, the 2 a.m. call that he writes about in his memoir from Bill Clinton, who's freaking out and feels like Clyburn had done wrong to Hillary in 2008 because it was so important. Then again, in 2016, we see the role that it played, and it was devastating to Bernie Sanders to get crushed that way, and it really exposed the big hole in his candidacy, which is he had almost no appeal to African American, and so it's poised to play a really big role. But here's why it's also important to Kamala Harris, because that is coming right on the eve of California. So she's about to go westward to her home turf, and so that gives her a whole lot of momentum.
Nolan, what else should we be watching for in South Carolina? You mentioned Harris was just there. Presumably she's going to be back a lot. But what are some of the kind of guideposts coming up down the road that we should be keeping an eye on there?
I think what's interesting right now is just how much candidates are trying to get to South Carolina versus Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, just to see what their rationale is, what their lane is, what they think they need to be doing. I mean, I think South Carolina is obviously very important to Kamala Harris. She also wants to do well in Iowa if she can, do well in New Hampshire if she can. But Democrats in South Carolina especially believe that the winner of that primary will become their nominee. They believe it's a gateway to the South. They believe if you win South Carolina, it gives you a lot of momentum going into California, going into Super Tuesday with all of the other southern states. So I think that's a big focus. The key question is, what are they doing there? Who are they talking to? What do their staffs look like? Do the staffs reflect the diversity of South Carolina? Mm-hmm. Are they talking to everybody in South Carolina? Are they only reaching out to people who look like them? Those are some questions and things to look forward to.
That's a really good point. Hey, before we end this segment, I want to make sure that we talk about the other candidate who launched this week. Charlie, why is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana running for president?
Pete Buttigieg, because he can, because this is a year where it's a great year for ambitious Democrats, because it's, in a lot of ways the party is transforming. There's a rage boiling at the grassroots there. There's an opening, and it's an opportunity to present lots of different diverse versions of where the party should be going in the future. And if you're a young Democrat, ambitious Democrat like Buttigieg, why not? Like, this is going to be your one shot. I mean, I'm sure if you got him, locked him in a room, and said, seriously, you don't really think you're going to win the nomination, he'd probably fess up, but the point is, you never know. In the Trump era, anyone can win, but also it's positioning him for the future. I mean, he's an exceptionally young guy, and those of us who have met him, he came to Politico, I guess it was a year or two.
A few years ago, he was very passionate about sewage systems, as I recall.
Exactly. And it didn't seem like he was totally ready for the national stage, but it was clear this was a very gifted public servant. He was smart. He was thoughtful. He has a really compelling story. And he's somebody who we're going to be hearing about for a long time. So why not run right now? I mean, he certainly belongs on that stage. He can compete at that level. And so I think that's why you're seeing people like him. And we'll also see some other candidates who might not have, in the past or traditionally been seen as ready for a presidential race, but now would be the moment to do it.
That's a great point. And also, just looking way in advance, it's going to be fascinating to see how things kind of shake out in Iowa, especially with all these candidates, right? Because who knows how many there are going to be, and there are those intricate rules that I think we talked about a few weeks ago in Iowa, wherein candidates can kind of throw their support to one another in different precincts depending on whether or not they reach certain thresholds of support. So it's going to be fascinating to see how it all shakes out. Nolan and Chris, thank you so much for being here. This is a great opportunity to talk through it all.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All All right, let's move on to our next data point, which is 2,750. That's the number of new Border Patrol agents that the president requested in his proposed immigration deal, a deal that was rejected within hours, minutes, seconds of being proposed, and has left now zero deals on any table, although there might be another one percolating. We'll get into that. That doesn't mean the president hasn't been busy, though. Joining us now is White House reporter Nancy Cook. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you for being here. And Nancy is going to walk us through the past week in the White House and in the shutdown, now into, I guess, finishing week five, moving into week six. Who knows? Nancy, rewind us back to early last weekend when the president announced he was going to be giving a big address from the White House announcing a big plan that presumably he was hoping was going to put a stop to the shutdown and get what he wanted. That's not what happened. Did Trump ever believe that this was going to work?
I don't think that the White House, anyone in the White House necessarily thought it would work, but I think that they felt like Trump was so much under siege, both in terms of polling and just in terms of public opinion, that he had to put something forward. But they definitely hyped it a lot. So, like, I was talking to White House people, you know, it started because Trump tweeted on Friday that he would be having, you know, a major announcement on the shutdown coming on Saturday. And he was doing it over a long weekend, Martin Luther King weekend, you know, as people were trying to get out of town and you know, school was out and things like that. And White House officials were also hyping it that Friday night. They were saying that Trump is going to present a deal to end the shutdown. But then when you ask some pressing questions like, is this a deal that the Democrats have seen? They wouldn't respond. And so Trump basically came out with this deal on Saturday in which he still demanded the same amount for border wall funding. But there was also some sense that he would, you know, give people some citizenship, DACA folks, but for limited periods of time, like 3 years, and also rescind some of the he had canceled some temporary protected status protections, which allows people to live here, you know, temporarily from different countries around the world if their country is in danger or, you know, there's war or famine there. So he'd offered to sort of extend those a bit more. The Department of Homeland Security has been canceling those. So that was the big announcement. But it was still a very political announcement. And Democrats, before the president even had given the speech, just as news of what it was going to say had started to leak out Saturday morning, they were already poo-pooing it. And so it really didn't take us anywhere. And where we are at this point is I talked to a bunch of White House people last night and this morning and also people close to the White House. And there is a sense internally that morale is plummeting. There is zero White House strategy. The negotiations with Congress, and honestly, they're not even really negotiations. They're kind of like talks, but they're very superficial. Those are being led by Vice President Mike Pence and Jared Kushner. Kushner is on a high from passing criminal justice reform in December, which is a big deal. But he's not someone that has deep relationships on the Hill. He's not someone who I think most people would say has a real intricate knowledge of how Washington works. And so when I talk to people, people are like, the White House is screwed. And meanwhile, the polling numbers continue to show that Americans are largely holding Trump and the Republicans responsible for the shutdown. And that really hasn't changed. And you know, we're going into another cycle tomorrow when federal workers will miss another paycheck. And so that pressure is always going to get more ramped up.
Is that the second paycheck now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Second paycheck.
Charlie?
Nancy, if the White House morale is down and they're feeling a little bit screwed, how much of this is due to Nancy Pelosi's positioning? Because the reason I ask is I feel like this has been – she's really stepped into this moment. And I'm somebody who thinks she's maybe over-lionized in Washington. But as a power politician, she's outstanding. And she has checkmated him at every instance, whether it was in the meeting – the original meeting in the White House on – you know, by rolling out the first State of the Union grenade, then in responding when he's at each point, she has had an effective response. He doesn't even have a nickname for her. I feel like she has been as effective in stepping on him as anyone we've seen in Washington so far. So is that just a crazy theory or is
no, that's 100%. On my way here this morning, Nancy Pelosi was having a presser this morning, and Trump appears to be like watching along the live presser and tweeting at Nancy Pelosi in real time. And he calls her Nancy. You know, he doesn't call – there's no, like, low-energy Jeb or whatever. There's no nicknames. I think that he has met his match, and I think that she is one of the only people in Washington that has really successfully challenged him. And we saw last night he has folded on the State of the Union. You know, they have been going back and forth for the past 2 weeks about, will the State of the Union still happen? It's supposed to happen this coming Tuesday, and where it would happen. And there was a lot of sort of tit for tat on that. He folded and just said, you know, we'll just do it after the shutdown ends. And that was a huge moment. I mean, the president does not back down almost ever. And there were so many people in the White House around him who were saying, let's have the State of the Union at the border. Let's have it like a rally at a Heartland. There was like 9,000 ideas, you know, swarming around as I talked to people last night in the early evening. And then later that night, he tweeted out, we're just not going to have it. I mean, I think this is one of the most interesting kind of personality fights we've seen in Washington in the last 2 years.
I feel like the strategic lacking is or the strategic thinking is lacking over in the White House, because it's almost like, so they come up with the idea, oh, here's what we'll do, Mr. President. You will say, I'm going no matter what. And then she's like, no, you're not. And he's like, OK. You know, I mean, there's just, they're not thinking around corners. They're not thinking in three dimensions. And no matter what they come up with, she draws the line and they can't respond.
Yeah, I think Trump's never been someone who like thinks like five steps down the line of what the strategy is going to be. I feel like his strategy is basically being relentless and like being willing to not necessarily stick to the facts. But that hasn't really worked here. And another interesting data point is that, you know, Mick Mulvaney has been the acting chief of staff basically for 3 or 4 weeks now. And you can see, as I talk to people, that he is starting to catch some of this flack, because one of his selling points for becoming the chief of staff was that he had the political chops that General John Kelly did not. And now people are saying, well, you're a former congressman. You know, you said you were going to understand politics, but you're letting Jared Kushner run the congressional negotiations. And by the way, like, no one knows how we're going to get ourselves out of this box.
Nancy, you mentioned the polling numbers and how, like, pretty consistently in the polls we've seen, people are blaming Trump more so than congressional Democrats. We've seen his approval ratings, which weren't great to start with, slide further down. Is there any sense of concern about that within the White House, or is do public polling numbers not carry any weight with Trump or people around him after his victory in 2016?
No, I think that people in the White House are very worried about the public polling numbers, and I think that they watch them and pay attention. I think that they've had this idea over the last like week or so that I've heard that, you know, Democrats will eventually cave because they'll get so much pressure from furloughed workers. But that just hasn't borne out so far. Democrats are not caving. And so just back to like the lack of strategy, like even their theories about how Democrats will behave are not bearing out. Like, I feel like they don't have any understanding of how the Democrats are going to act. They haven't been able to really kind of figure out and track what Pelosi's going to do. And she's just like keeps outsmarting them.
Well, that's been a problem for both White Houses and both parties for a long time, right, Charlie? That it seems like there's just something about being a presidential administration that destroys your radar for like figuring out what the other party wants and will do to get it.
Yeah, and then in this case, though, they're operating in a vacuum where all the rules in the past are sort of out the window.
By their undoing.
Right, exactly, and because they blew them up. And so all of a sudden they find themselves with a foe who is – it turns out that Nancy Pelosi, you know, for all her experience, for, you know, for someone who's been around for a long time, also knows how to operate in this kind of free-form, ruleless environment. And her instincts are proving, I think, really successful.
But I think that you can tell Republicans are starting to feel the heat because Mitch McConnell is coming off the sidelines a bit. You know, he had a meeting with you know, Kushner and Pence sort of publicly so that people could see. I do know that he has back channel sort of having conversations with Trump, you know, but he's starting tweeting. He said he's going to bring up some bills on the Senate floor. Like, I feel like we're starting to see him, who does not like controversy, weighed in a bit. And to me, most people I talk to think that the White House is not going to be key to solving this. It's basically going to be once Mitch McConnell starts to play, you know, him and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer will cut a deal and basically tell the White House what it is. And so that to me shows like maybe it won't be forever anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
But you know, the same thing happened like even with tax reform, for instance. It was basically like a Hill project that the White House like proposed. And so it works much better when they just cut the White House out.
It was interesting, and tell me if I'm overinterpreting this, but you and our colleague Eliana Johnson reported this week that the White House congressional liaison is leaving in the middle of all this. That seems like a bit of a tell toward what you're saying, right? That there's just no meaningful communication there.
Yeah, it's a huge tell. I mean, Shahira Knight was one of the key White House staffers to help them pass tax reform. She's really knowledgeable on policy. She worked on the Hill. She has really good relationships with members. People like her. She's seen as tough. But she's basically been, you know, sidelined a bit because Jared has been taking over these congressional negotiations with Pence. And I feel like if it wasn't such a newsy week, it would have gotten even more buzz that, you know, she's starting to look around outside and figure out what else she could do. I mean, it says a lot that the White House's person who's their liaison to Congress wants to leave in the middle of a government shutdown.
Yeah. Two more questions for you. Are we going to be having you back next week to continue talking about the shutdown? Or do you think it could resolve itself in the next 7 days?
I mean, never say never, right?
Yeah.
I didn't think it would go on this long, but I feel like while things seem to be percolating potentially with McConnell and Republicans feeling the heat, I don't see it ending that immediately. And also the White House, the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, excuse me, that's kind of like overseeing which agencies open up and how that works and what gets funded, yesterday put out a call asking agencies to think through how they would deal with a government shutdown that heads into February and March.
Mm.
So they're definitely planning for this potentially to go on.
And now my second question, is there any rumbling of kind of outside action of the sort that might force someone's hand on this? You had mentioned the kind of last week, the theory that some sort of action by TSA workers could potentially play a role in forcing the end of the shutdown. Is there any hint of organizing by furloughed government workers or anything like that?
We're starting to see more and more, like there was a protest in Hart, which was the Senate building this week, by furloughed workers. And we're starting to see like TSA workers, for instance, call out sick in greater numbers. But I don't think that we're seeing any sort of mass scale strikes or anything like that that will really force their hand. I do think that people in the White House and around it continue to think that, like, until there's that kind of event, it's unclear what will get us out of this. And they're desperate for something, you know, be it like an executive action that Trump could take that would help him save face, or, you know, just something like that where they can get out of this box that they've put themselves in.
Well, actually, that prompts one more question for you. So why hasn't Trump done what he threatened to do and declared a national emergency at the border and just taken the money from somewhere else? Is it because he knows that a court would immediately step in, or is something else at play?
That idea was very, very hot a few weeks ago. I'm sort of losing track of time, but honestly. But his lawyers, and it's his new legal team, because basically the whole White House counsel's office has turned over, were not hot on that idea. They really worried about what it could legally do. And then, you know, Trump really listens to kind of conservative pundits and people in the media. And those folks, some of them were also very worried about the precedent that it would set. Like, if you declare a national emergency to get your border wall, you know, Democrat could also declare a national emergency down the line for something like climate change or, you know, Medicare for all. And I think that that message has gotten through in the White House that that's not a good precedent to set.
Got it. All right. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for telling us all about it. We'll talk to you again next week.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me.
And Charlie, thank you as always for being here.
Thanks, Scott.
And as always, a big thank you to all of you for tuning in and listening this week. Our producer is Micaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. Remember, if you would like to read those credits instead of me, just send an email to nerdcast@politico.com and say you'd like to read the credits. It's a blast, let me tell you. Thank you again for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.